notated on the slide, but also some newer work that is in progress with Will Donnelly. Now, since this is a conference on the foundations of physics, I want to remind you that with quantum gravity, we really do seem to face a foundational crisis for fundamental physics. And that becomes particularly sharp and evident when we think about black hole evolution. We run into the so-called unitarity crisis, otherwise sometimes known as the information problem or paradox. But also we see some serious problems with the long-time paradoxes and puzzles that we encounter in inflationary cosmology. So we really seem to be running into a serious crisis here in the foundations of physics. And one way of thinking about it is we seem to have a conflict between our most basic principles. Those are the principles of quantum mechanics, the principle of locality, and the principles of relativity. And those, of course, are the cornerstones of local quantum field theory, which describes all observed phenomena that we've, at least so far, been able to experimentally or observationally access. So what do we do in this situation? And obviously, a first question is, well, what should we trust and what shouldn't we trust? And I'm going to take the point of view that, for example, quantum mechanics, as we know, is very well tested. And moreover, if you try to modify quantum mechanics, you find various problems occurring. You know, we've seen, for example, with Hawking's initial proposal for modifying quantum mechanics, the trouble that caused, and so on. So quantum mechanics is a, it seems, very rigid structure. Likewise with, say, some of the basic elements of of relativity more generally, Poincaré invariance and at least sort of a local version of that, Diff invariance. You know, Poincaré invariance has been quite well tested, and also it's hard to sensibly modify, although there have certainly been attempts, and you know, maybe that's the route to go. But I'm going to take the viewpoint that, in fact, these are the more robust principles. But on the other hand, locality, if you think about it, is hard to even formulate in a quantum theory of gravity. We don't even have a precise statement of it, in a sense, and that's going to be part of the focus of the talk. So with that preamble, I'm going to assume that we're dealing with a theory that is quantum mechanical. That means we have a Hilbert space, and that brings us to a second aspect of the conference going on. The basic story of quantum mechanics involves very much information conservation, information sharing and entanglement, information exchange and transfer. Those are all aspects of many of the quantum mechanical theories that we think about. So information has been called, well, the currency of nature or of quantum mechanics. But we face an even more basic question, I think, in quantum gravity, before we start discussing these aspects of information. Namely, there's this more basic question of what additional structure is first needed to characterize entanglement, transfer, and so on. You need more than just a Hilbert space. You need some additional structure on that Hilbert space, something that, for example, allows you to localize information. And so let's hone in on that a little bit more. The nature of this localization structure and its relationship to usual locality, in fact, I think is a key question in quantum gravity. And again, it seems to me it's a question that very much, it needs to be addressed first before we start talking about information exchange and entanglement and so on. So how do we ordinarily provide this additional structure? And I think most of you know the classic example of how we provide such an additional structure is to assume that there's a factorization, a tensor factorization of whatever Hilbert space we're dealing with. Then we can have entanglement between the two factors. We can transfer information from one factor to the other, and so on. We're ready to discuss familiar aspects of information theory in physics. More generally, we typically think about what I'll call locally finite systems. By that, I mean systems with a locally finite number of degrees of freedom. Classic example being the lattice. And there, likewise, we represent the Hilbert space in terms of a tensor factorization. We have a tensor factor structure and break it up into a bunch of individual Hilbert spaces. And that's our additional structure that allows, again, discussion of entanglement, transfer, and so on. So if we want to do physics, this is something very basic. And if, you know, quantum gravity is part of quantum mechanics, we would like something like this kind of structure to really get started discussing information theory and aspects of information transfer. Oops, wrong direction. but one other comment on this. With quantum gravity, we also expect a correspondence principle. Basically, that tells you that when you work at the limit of, in the limit of weak fields, the more basic theory of quantum gravity should match on to local quantum field theory. And there are actually some questions with local quantum field theory, or really puzzles, regarding this tensor factor structure. Well, actually, I shouldn't say puzzles. They're actually obstructions to having a tensor factor structure in local quantum field theory for two reasons. The first reason is that if you think about long-range gauge fields in quantum field theory, then those lead to at least some difficulty in really factorizing the Hilbert space. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute. That will be a part of the focus here. Before that, let me mention the other reason, and that's the so-called type 3 property. Here I'm referring to type 3 von Neumann algebras. And basically, that's the statement that we typically have infinite entanglement in local quantum. So let me just give a simple example that illustrates this. If we think about, say, Minkowski space, which I've drawn a little picture of, in the Rindler representation, well, we might think we can factorize the Hilbert space in terms of a left Hilbert space and a right Hilbert space. Actually, typically, we do something that's sort of close to that. But when you look more carefully, it's not a true factorization. More precisely, we write, for example, the Minkowski vacuum, as I show on the bottom of the slide, is this exponential of creation operators, which create particles on the left side or on the right side, acting on the product of the left and right vacuum. And that really is a state thought of in terms of this decomposition, which has, you know, truly infinite entanglement. Sort of a cartoon of that state is given in the line below. This is sort of the qubit approximation to that state. And we really have a product over an infinite number of possible excitations. And for each pair, we have entanglement. So there's really infinite entanglement there. And that is at least one way of understanding what this type 3 property is. And it really tells you that, you know, if you're properly, say, keeping the symmetries of the theory, you don't have a true factorization of the Hilbert space. Of course, you can, and this is where the asterisk comes in, you can take the Hilbert space and, or actually take the theory and regulate it, say, by putting in a cutoff of some sort or putting it on a lattice. And then you can get back to something that's factorizable. But that involves really breaking the basic symmetry of the theory, breaking Lorentz invariance in order to do that. And one still encounters, say, cutoff dependent terms and so on, which in the end we'd like to, you know, be able to take the cutoff away. So this is a basic feature of quantum field theory. In fact, there's a theorem that local quantum field theories all have this type 3 property. So how do we deal with that? You know, obviously we have a notion of locality in local quantum field theory. And the way that we deal with that is we work instead of with a factorization with an algebra of observables. And we localize by thinking about subalgebras of that algebra of observables. So for example, we might consider different regions in space-time. I've drawn some here. And if O1 and O2 are space-like separated, then we can associate with each of those regions subalgebras. Basically, in a simple field theory like a scalar field theory, we can smear the scalar field operator against functions with support only in those two regions. And those subalgebras will commute, again, for space-like separated regions. And so that's how we really encode locality in local quantum field theory. And then going one step further, we can consider, for example, overlapping regions, as I've also pictured, and intersections between regions, as I've indicated, and sort of build up a net, roughly speaking, associated with, well, something like the open sets in the space-time manifold. And that net of subalgebras, which all fit together in a nice way, sort of represents the space-time manifold and more. It allows you to reconstruct the space-time manifold. So this is the basic approach of algebraic quantum field theory. And a good reference for that is the classic book by Hogg, Local Quantum Physics. So that's how we get around the question of not really having true factorizations of the Hilbert space. Instead, we have subalgebras. So coming back to gravity, suppose gravity does fit within the principles of quantum mechanics. Suppose that gravity is truly quantum mechanical. Well, in any quantum mechanical system, first of all, the algebra of observables should play a very basic role. And given what I've just said about the desire to match onto local quantum field theory in the correspondence limit, we should be asking whether that algebra of observables has any interesting subalgebra structure. And again, another way of stating what the correspondence limit is, it's what you get when you take G Newton to zero, and we know that in that limit we should be matching back onto local quantum field theory, and we should have a precise notion of these kinds of subalgebras encoding locality. We're assuming gravity is described within quantum mechanics. Let's also assume that weak gravity is approximately described by general relativity. That's sort of another, sort of taking the correspondence one step further. And that really means that whatever the more basic theory is, at least in this correspondence limit, we have something that is basically behaves like a long-range gauge field, as we all know. And so that leads to this first subtlety in tensor factor or obstacle, really, to tensor factorizations. There's a question of what to do when you have long-range gauge fields. And so to warm up to that question, what I will do is first talk about an even simpler and more familiar theory, and that's QED. Here I mean scalar QED, just for simplicity. We've written down the Lagrangian, the covariant derivative, and so on. Now, in QED, if you set the charge to zero, the charge of the scalar we're talking about, a basic observable of the theory is just the scalar field, and that acts on the vacuum or on other states to create or destroy particles. And then the question becomes, well, if the charge is not zero, if it's actually coupled to electromagnetism, how do we write down a sensible observable, and here I mean a gauge invariant observable, because ultimately we would like our observables to be gauge invariant, so they actually act to take physical states to physical states. Now, of course, phi, if as a charge, is not gauge invariant, and that's closely associated with the statement, here I'm talking about a scalar, but we could just as well describe fermions, that an electron in QED is just inseparable from its electric field. If you're going to create an electron, you can't do that without creating its electric field, and so somehow you have to account for that. So that's the first observation, but of course this electric field can have different kinds of configurations, which we might also refer to as dressings. And so I'll start with a very simple example of a dressing, what Dirac called a Faraday line. These days we refer to this kind of construction as a Wilson line. We can take the scalar field, let's say scalar field operator, and put it at the origin just to make things simple. And then we can multiply it by an exponential of the integral of the gauge field, say along the z-axis. And it's easy to see that that gives you something that is now gauge invariant. It transforms trivially under gauge transformations. And physically what we're doing, coming back to the electron being inseparable from its field, physically what we're doing is we're including the electric field produced by the electron, but we're running that field off, all the field lines off in the z direction. So we can act with that operator on the vacuum, and that's a gauge invariant construction. Now, that is not such a sort of physically reasonable or sensible configuration of the electric field of an electron. You have all the field lines running off in a thin tube to infinity along the z-axis. Oh, actually, before I say that, let me just say how we know, another way of knowing that that is the configuration we're dealing with. For example, we can take the operator I just gave you, and we can commute it with, say, the electric field operator, and we find that that commutator gives us something proportional to the charge, a transverse delta function, and then it's supported for positive z times the original operator. So that's how we see that that's what we're producing. But as I was just saying, this is a rather unnatural field configuration. If you create an electron with all of its field lines, tightly constrained like that, that's going to evolve forward in time, and the field lines will fan out, and you'll get some radiation. So let's think about a more realistic, say, field configuration, or a more natural one. And one simple way of doing that is to just take what we have and make it more symmetric by averaging over all angles, average the Wilson line or Faraday over all angles. And if you do that, you can show pretty straightforwardly that you get the electric field dressed by a different operator, exponential of the gauge field integrated against what actually looks like a radial electric field. And that's basically the Dirac dressing, as originally proposed in a classic paper by Dirac. And in terms of what it creates, down here, I've sort of drawn a picture of that. What you're doing is you're creating the electron together with field lines sort of equally pointing in all directions. So you're really just creating the Coulomb field of the particle, or you're creating the particle together with its Coulomb field if you act with this operator. And you can see that again directly if you look at the commutator of the electric field with this Dirac-dressed operator, and that gives you the charge and then basically the standard formula for the Coulomb field of the electron or scalar charge in this case. Now, that's still not all the way to where we would like to be, because we would like to not necessarily just have the static field of a static particle, but say we'd like to think about the creation operator that creates a particle with some momentum, for example. So how do we incorporate the state of motion of the particle? And a more general dressing it has been described in some papers by Begin, Lavelle, and McMullen, and they give a construction, which I'll just go over very briefly here. They give a construction which will accommodate the state of motion of the particle. And the idea is to start with the Dirac field, and then, so that's represented here. And then we can include an extra operator, which is basically the integral of the gauge field along the world line in green here, and up to the point where the particle is now. And so this construction, actually, you can see, or well, Begin, Lavelle, and McMullen show, for example, gives you the boosted Coulomb field if you take T goes to, well, minus T goes to minus infinity far in the past, and consider, for example, a world line that corresponds to constant momentum. Okay, so bottom line, there are various dressings that are possible, and you can make them quite realistic. So the next question is, what does this tell you about the algebra of observables? So we've come up with some gauge invariant operators that can give you building blocks for that algebra. What do we learn? Well, let's look at the commutators of these operators. And for starters, I can take two Faraday or Wilson lines and run them off in the opposite directions. And clearly, if I have the two points x and x prime space-like separated, that will give me a construction where the operators commute. But on the other hand, if I take the points x and x prime to be lined up in the z direction, and I run the Faraday lines off to infinity, both in the same direction, then they run into each other, and it's not so hard to show that you get a non-zero commutator between the operators in that case. So that extends when we're averaging these field lines over all directions to get a Coulomb-like field. That extends to the story with the Coulomb field. And for example, the commutator of the Dirac-dressed operator with, actually, it's easiest to think about the commutator with the time derivative operator with the time derivative of the operator at the other point. This commutator is non-vanishing for the same reason. Basically, we pick up a contribution when the field lines overlap. And likewise for this world line construction that I briefly described. And in fact, you can figure out the size of the commutators, and they're a nice familiar looking expression, something like the Coulomb energy, Q squared over the separation between the particles. So these operators in general don't commute. And so that might lead you to conclude that there are no local subalgebras in QED. And then, of course, you might ask the question, how do we formulate locality in QED? But as we know, that's not quite the correct statement, because we could always take a charge and a charge of equal magnitude and opposite sign nearby and run one of these Faraday lines between them, and we get something, an operator that creates that combined state that's localized to a neighborhood. And we can do the same thing in another neighborhood over here, and these operators will commute. So this is how we get to the basic local structure of QED, because we can always sort of localize our field lines by considering basically neutral objects. Okay, so now let's turn to the question of gravity, unless there are any questions so far.
Any questions? Do you have a question?
No. No, there are no questions.
Okay. We'll press on.
Yeah.
So gravity has some similar properties and some different properties. And so we start with the basic Lagrangian. The gauge invariance is diffeomorphism invariance. A field phi of x, say, if we're coupling gravity to a scalar, is not gauge invariant because it transforms non-trivially under these diffeomorphisms. I've just written, of course, an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. And so phi of x is not gauge invariant. That's related to the statement, or really equivalent to the statement, that we can't create just a particle, say an electron, all by itself. An electron is inseparable not only from its electric field, but from its gravitational field. And so we need to account for the fact that, really in creating the particle, we have to also create its gravitational field. So let's study this just in the linearized theory. Of course, we have in mind the full nonlinear construction, but the nonlinear construction deleting order will be given by the linearized theory or linearized construction. So we can just focus on that to get a feeling for how things work. So let's consider perturbations about Minkowski space. Of course, the field perturbation transforms also under diffeomorphisms. And what we'd like to do is come up with a, so to speak, dressed operator that is gauge invariant. And we're going to do that, at least a kind of construction we can explore is where we take the field phi to be a function of x mu plus a dressing term that is a functional of the metric. And so the question is, how do we come up with something gauge invariant of that form? In the simplest possible example, like with electromagnetism, is to think about a gravitational Wilson line. One way of explaining what you're doing here, how you're making sort of this creation of the particle phi a diff invariant, is we can give a diff invariant characterization of where we create the particle if we sort of fix coordinates at infinity and then shoot in a geodesic in a definite direction. We're going to imagine that diffeomorphisms don't act at infinity. So we can pick out a definite direction and shoot that geodesic in for a given geodesic distance, and that defines where we're creating the particle. And that will be an invariant characterization in terms of the diffeomorphisms that act, say, in the vicinity of where the particle is created, or anywhere away from infinity. Another way of stating that is we could work in the gauge where hz mu is equal to zero, and there this geodesic distance is just the z coordinate. Way of sort of expressing more generally, though, working in some other set of coordinates, what we're doing is that we have a v mu. It comes from basically solving the geodesic equation that takes this form. So it's an integral of the Christoffel symbols, which, of course, come from the metric. If you do this, I've described why it should be gauge invariant, but you can check. If you do this, if you have a V of this form, then you indeed find that you have a gauge invariant expression here. And again, it's very similar to the story of electromagnetism. And moreover, it's similar in what you're actually creating if you act with this operator. If you act with this operator, what you create is a particle together with its gravitational field lines, but not in the usual Coulomb configuration. The field lines are all sort of constrained to a narrow tube that go, and they go out to infinity along the z-axis. So of course, that's not such a nice field for a particle to have. It's a singular field, and we expect it to be unstable in the nonlinear theory, in the linear theory. And of course, in gravity, we also have to account for we also have to account for nonlinearities. One second. Let me get rid of the phone. Okay. Should have taken it off the hook.
All right.
We have to account for the nonlinearities as well in general. Nonlinearities also will lead to instability of this field, you shouldn't constrain all these gravitational field lines to a narrow region that produces a lot of energy. Okay, so now let's try to find a more reasonable field configuration, since we know that's not such a reasonable one. Like in QED, we can just average the field lines over all directions. And that gives us an expression that looks something like this for this vector functional, which we're putting inside the scalar field. And that is going to give us now an operator, which basically creates the particle plus a Coulomb-like field, gravitational Coulomb-like field. What's a gravitational Coulomb-like field? Well, at the linear level, it's going to be linearized Schwarzschild, and you can check that that's what this construction gives you. So we're creating a particle plus its linear Schwarzschild field extending out to infinity if we act with this operator. More generally, we can account for the, a non-trivial state of motion, for example, a momentum of the particle by a construction very similar to that in QED. We can write down a world line dressing where we have we start with a Coulomb field, and then we basically have a similar line integral along the world line. The particle is followed up to where it is now, and that is a way of getting at the boosted Schwarzschild field, for example. Okay, so like with QED, in gravity, there are different kinds of dressings you can consider. And once you include these, you can write down gauge invariant operators. Basic gauge invariant operators correspond to creating particles plus their gravitational fields. What consequences should we draw for the structure of the algebra? A question just like we asked before. And this is almost the same slide. We can have Wilson lines going off in the opposite direction. Those should commute. Although, again, you have to think about the nonlinearity here. We're not just working in the linear theory. So these are a little bit more non-trivial in the full nonlinear theory of gravity. But then, of course, if you take Wilson lines and run them in the same direction so that they overlap, you're going to have a non-zero commutator, just like in QED. For the same reason, if you average over all directions to build the Coulomb-like fields, then you will also have non-trivial commutators between these operators, whether you're talking about the actual, well, analog of the Dirac construction or a more general world line construction that gives you, say, a boosted particle. And you can estimate, actually, you can compute how big the commutators are, and they're of this size, G Newton times the product of energies, or masses, if we work in the large mass limit, over the separation. Okay, so what might we conclude from this as the consequences for the algebra? We might, like with QED, initially come to the conclusion that there are no local subalgebras in gravity. And in fact, well, in QED, we found there was a way around this because we could have a charge and a negative charge nearby. But in gravity, the field lines can't end. There are no negative energies or masses. And so the field lines always make it off to infinity. There's no, another way of putting it is there's no screening in gravity, except there's a somewhat more subtle situation that occurs in a closed universe, for example, with positive cosmological constant. But let's focus on asymptotic Minkowski space or even anti-de Sitter space. So we appear to encounter an irreducible non-locality in quantum gravity. Non-locality in the algebra of gauge invariant operators. And I don't see a clear way to avoid this, this statement that you don't have local algebras. And so coming back to what that means for the story of information and so on, we don't have an obvious definition of a local subsystem. Again, just to review, factorizations of the Hilbert space were problematic to begin with. We're supposed to be looking for subalgebras that characterize local subsystems. And we found that in gravity, just based on the general properties of Einstein's theory of general relativity, we don't have such local subalgebras. And so this seems to me to be a challenge to sharp definitions of information flow and entanglement and so on, if we don't have sharp definitions of subsystems. And this is something, it seems to me, we should think about very carefully in gravity. So just some further comments. I guess I've got probably about, what, 5 more minutes?
Yeah, you have about 7 minutes.
Okay, great. I should be able to finish in time, no problem. So our first question is, when is this lack of commutativity significant? And again, I wrote down the size of the commutators. Here I've written commutators of the fields, not the field and the derivative. So when does this term become of order 1? When does the commutator get to be large? And basically that happens when the separation between the two particles that you're trying to create is of order g times e, or if you're working in d-dimensional space-time, g times e over g times e to the 1 over d minus 3. In other words, the Schwarzschild radius. And that comes back to an earlier proposal that I made at first with my student Lippert about where we expect a sort of locality not, or a local quantum field theory description not to be a correct description in the context of gravity. Basically, this is reproducing that kind of statement, but now phrased in terms of the commutators. We referred to this as the locality bound. That's the first observation. A second observation is, I imagine there are at least some ADS CFT aficionados in the audience. And one of the big questions is, in approaching ADS CFT, how do we get at the bulk physics? Now, if that's possible, then one way to approach it is to think about trying to understand the natural subalgebras that would correspond to at least as local as we can get in the bulk, the closest we can get to local subalgebras in the bulk. Of course, in ADS CFT, we're trying to represent bulk gravity in ADS in terms of a boundary gauge theory, a boundary field theory. And so we do have a natural subalgebra structure in the boundary theory associated with subregions like we had in QED. But the question is, what's the right subalgebra structure or approximate subalgebra structure that is associated with locality in the bulk of ADS? And we might try to address that as part of the question of how do we decode the hologram and infer properties of bulk gravity from boundary theory. So this is a possible approach. But more generally, whether or not we get a description of quantum gravity from ADS CFT, I think these observations raise an interesting set of questions, or really a question, and I'll also make a suggestion. First, the question, so how do we get approximate locality or an approximate subalgebra structure from a more basic quantum mechanical theory that's our underlying theory of quantum gravity? And in what sense is it approximate? You can imagine two possibilities. One is that the basic theory does have some interesting subalgebra structure, and that in the, say, G Newton goes to zero limit matches on to the subalgebra structure we're familiar with. Although, we have to think about the fact that, even when gravity is turned on, we don't have precise subalgebras. We have to deal with this non-commutativity. And the other possibility is, again, that the subalgebra structure is not, at least the familiar local quantum field theory subalgebra structure, is not sort of hardwired into the basic theory or doesn't correspond to a subalgebra structure in the basic theory. It only comes out in the approximation where you go to vanishing Newton's constant. So there's an interesting set of questions there, really. And the suggestion is that, here we're finding a challenge to sharply formulating locality. We really don't see how to do it. And in fact, we're running into what seems to be a suggestion that there is not an exact notion of locality, at least not of this kind, in quantum gravity. And coming back to the sharp problem of unitarization of black hole evolution, well, the obstruction to information getting out of a black hole is locality. But if locality is not a precise element of the theory, we're naturally led to suggest that the information transfer or apparent information transfer, if you think about things with respect to the semi-classical geometry that's necessary to give a unitary description, that may be associated with this lack of sharpness or failure of exact locality in the more basic theory. And so I've, in other work, which I'm not going to describe here, given candidate sort of effective descriptions, if you're trying to parameterize things as a deviation from the semi-classical story, candidate descriptions for how that non-locality might lead to unitarization of black hole evolution. And, so one is led to suggest that maybe that comes out of this more basic structure where of the quantum theory of gravity where you don't have precise locality. And let me just mention, if these kinds of effective descriptions are indeed getting at the correct physics, they even lead to possible observational signatures at the Event Horizon Telescope. So here's another reference on that. So just to conclude, this is my last slide, the high points of the talk. I think it's reasonable to at least explore the make the assumption that quantum gravity fits within the framework of quantum mechanics. It's a truly quantum mechanical theory. It respects the principles of quantum mechanics, at least appropriately generalized. Now, for doing physics, studying things like information transfer, we want a localization or subsystem structure. Tensor factors are not things we truly have in continuum local quantum field theory. Instead, we focus on the algebra of observables and particularly subalgebras of that algebra. But the problem of long-range fields gives us some added challenge. We do ultimately find local subalgebras in QED, opposite charges connected by Wilson lines. But in gravity, we found an obstruction to the existence of such local subalgebras due to the fact that, say, gravity doesn't you can't screen gravity is one way of putting it. And to me, it seems that the non-locality that we've seen here is plausibly an important element, ultimately, of the fundamental structure of the quantum theory of gravity. And finally, I've suggested that might have something to do with explaining how we give a unitary description of black hole formation and evaporation. Of course, what the mistake we're making, so to speak, when we conclude that we don't have a unitary story is assuming locality. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the very nice talk. Are there any questions? Yeah. Let me walk around with a microphone so that they can hear you.
Okay.
Hi. So I think that's a very interesting take in this in the gravitation.
By the way, can
you hear us? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear. I'm just wondering who is asking the question.
Oh, I'm Robert Oeckel.
Let me try to see if I can put the camera.
Oh, on. Okay. Yeah.
That's fine. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. So I'm Robert Oeckel. So I think that's it's a quite interesting take on thinking about the observable of gravity and finding these obstructions to localization. What I would like to ask you is, of course, this approach of using the ingredients of local quantum field theory, these algebras, this net of algebras has a more fundamental obstruction in a quantum gravitational context. I mean, once you want to do a non-perturbative gravity and you don't have a fixed causal structure on your background, then, I mean, you wouldn't even be able to talk about these algebras in the usual sense, because you wouldn't know what means space-like separation, and so you wouldn't know when elements of the algebra would have to commute or not. Do you have some idea what to do about that, or something in that direction?
Yeah, that's also, I think, an important observation. I think it's a related observation. Let me at least phrase one way of thinking about it. So if we take the point of view that quantum gravity is quantum mechanical, then what do we have? We have a Hilbert space, and we should have an algebra of observables. And then we could ask whether that algebra of observables does have any interesting subalgebras. And here we may have to work in, say, in, well, there may be a sort of state dependence. We may have to think about things in a certain super selection sector, say, corresponding to states built on asymptotic Minkowski space. But you could still ask whether there are any interesting subalgebras, whether that's part of the basic structure of the theory. And then later, when you sort of take the correspondence limit, you might associate those with something like approximate subregions. So you could imagine, I think, a way of getting out something where you have regions emerging in an approximation. But, you know, it goes back to, you know, the more basic question of what the subalgebra structure is.
So next question comes.
Yes, Steve, Gerard het Hoofd speaking. Throwing away locality is one thing, but if that also goes at the price of throwing away causality, then is that not a much more serious problem?
I think so. You know, ultimately, the reason we worry about throwing away causality is because that is very, very close to throwing away consistency, and we'd better not do that. So, you know, there is, I think, a deep question here of, how do we get out something that looks approximately local, and how do we get out, a theory that has the correct consistency properties to say, in the end look causal from a more basic framework that that doesn't have the usual locality, and you know, that's sort of a deep puzzle. But I want to emphasize, I'm not, at least in this talk, proposing throwing out locality. I'm saying you think about basic properties of gravity and you can't find it, so you know, it's not there. So you were kind of stuck with that situation, and I think we have to face up to that. I do have to say that, you know, when you think about these effective parameterizations of black hole evolution and think about, say, modifying locality as describing information coming out of a black hole, say, there's a connection between locality and causality that comes from basically from the symmetries of Minkowski space, and that connection no longer applies if you're in a black hole background. So, you know, there are added subtleties there. It's the usual statement that, you know, if I'm just in Minkowski space and I have propagation at space-like separation, I can perform a Lorentz transformation to turn that into backwards in time propagation. You know, that's not something that is necessarily a general statement. You need that symmetry argument to turn non-locality into a causality. So that doesn't necessarily always hold.
Okay, we're going to pass you on.
Hi, Guillaume Verdun here, a master's student here.
Okay.
So Hi. You said you had a breakdown of the locality in your theory, because you didn't have a negative gravitational charge, but in QFT we can often have locally a negative energy density. And if you were to consider such cases as a negative gravitational charge, could that potentially fix your problems?
Well, you know, potentially if you really did have something, you know, some robust description of negative mass, negative energies, then, you know, that might be a way out. But it really seems that, you know, even though we might get away with something like negative energy, you know, very temporarily, that in general, that's not part of the structure of the theory, and that, you know, ultimately, well, for example, you know, we know the story in quantum field theory that if you have a little bit of negative energy, quickly, you know, positive energy and more is nearby, so to speak. So it really looks like there is not a simple way out along those lines. It, you know, it looks like that's fairly hardwired into things, unless we're looking at an even bigger departure from the familiar story.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Steve. It's Lee Smolin. And first, that's a beautiful, beautiful talk. That should be chapter one of any textbook on quantum gravity.
Thank you.
It's basic things we all should reflect on. I have one suggestion which has been discussed over the years, and which, I mean, obviously this motivates all the work on non-perturbative quantum gravity, and your Wilson lines turn into the graphs and spin networks in loop quantum gravity, and that's why they're there. But one suggestion which people explore some from time to time is not just working with asymptotic boundaries as you suggest with ADS, but defining physical conditions, either conditions of horizons or using matter fields to define physical surfaces, and defining subalgebras of observables on those diffeomorphically defined surfaces. And you get relations between those subalgebras coming from inclusions and topological relationships between the surfaces and the resulting subalgebras.
Yeah, thank you. You know, one of the things I get puzzled about, and that actually is part of the origin of the present project, sort of warming up to that and some discussions with Will Donnelly, you know, there's sort of a question how to define, say, a surface in space-time in a gauge-invariant way. And, you know, you might ultimately try to do something relationally. But when you do things relationally, I think you probably run into a similar story, you know, more elaborate, though, to the one I've told today. But anyway, it'd be worth sort of probing this whole story further.
Those are good questions. At the level of just spatial diffeomorphism invariant observables, there are constructions of commuting subalgebras on surfaces defined diffeomorphically.
Diff-invariantly?
Yeah.
So my naive response is if I have a surface which I put here and I act on it with a diffeomorphism, you know, it will go over here. So how do I, that prescription is not diff invariant. So how do I give a diff invariant description?
Well, Laurent has more exciting things to say, so I'll give it to him in a minute. But the diffeomorphism moves the matter degrees of freedom that define the surfaces, and it moves all the Wilson lines as well.
Good. Okay. So it is related. Yeah, that's okay. I think you're referring to what I would call something relational, where you have you're localizing with respect to physical features of the state, say, defined by the matter configuration and so on. So, yeah, that I think is at least one way to approach these things. I agree. Yeah.
Hi, Steve. This is Laurent Fredel.
Hi.
Likely, you know, I think it's a beautiful talk. I like, you know, Gauss's law plus the absence of neutralization. Yeah, I think it's a very clean way of, you know, illustrating the issue. Maybe two questions. One is you didn't comment too much on the robustness of effective locality. Like, you know, as you say, it's fundamentally with gravity we have non-locality. But, you know, I want to know a little bit how you understand the fact that we have this robustness of effective locality, so that we are somehow you know, tricked into believing that everything is local. But the second thing also is maybe you haven't touched on is what's the next step? So let's say, you know, you establish that, and that's a constatation on the basic facts about gravity and the quantum. But where does that point towards? So clearly, you know, locality is a building principle for all the theories we know, and causality. And in fact, it goes hand in hand, you know, locality and causality. So clearly, you're pointing towards, you know, we have to change that. Therefore, we have to, you know, investigate a replacement of some of our principle of locality by something a bit deeper. Yep. Have you thought about it? I mean, I have something, you know, in mind, which, for instance, relative locality is an idea, but I wanted to know whether you have thought about that next step.
Yeah, I've thought about it a lot, but do I have much concrete I can say about it right now? Less true, but just to comment, or well, let me briefly address the questions in turn. So effective locality, you know, I think that's a very good question. You know, if you start out with a theory that's just some arbitrary non-local theory, you know, how do we get out something that looks like a local theory, you know, which holds to a very, very good approximation? Local quantum field theory, you know, in the limit when G Newton is equal to zero, is exactly local. How do we, you know, where does locality come from? And by the way, this has been one of the puzzles, at least I personally have had, with the story of ADS-CFT, because you need to get out bulk locality, which is different from boundary locality. Where does that come from? And yes. And so I don't have a sharp answer to that question, but that must be part of the more basic structure. So that, in, you know, some feature of the more basic theory that you get out this approximate locality, and you could ask where it comes from. Now, of course, one possibility, and this is starting to address the second question, is that it does reflect properties of the more basic theory, such as some interesting subalgebra structure in the more basic theory that, you know, it may not look like subalgebras associated with regions in the full quantum theory, but, you know, in the G goes to zero, in the semi-classical limit, it may give you subalgebras associated with regions, at least, you know, modulo the presence of gravitational field lines and so on.
You mean subcommuting algebras? When you talk about subalgebras, could you precise a bit more what you mean?
Yeah, I mean commuting subalgebra,
okay.
For example. So what is the next step? Well, I think, at least for me, it seems that, let me make a general statement along those lines. You know, we've spent a lot of time over the last decades, starting with a description of gravity in terms of space-time and trying to quantize it. And we... you know, run into all kinds of trouble in doing that. We've had, you know, confusion after confusion. I think, you know, very sharp problems like the unitarization crisis for the unitarity crisis for black holes. But, you know, maybe we're coming at this from the wrong direction. You know, if we're really dealing with a quantum mechanical theory, and I recognize there are some people who may want to modify, or who do want to modify quantum mechanics, but let's not take that step yet. We're really dealing with a quantum mechanical theory, then maybe we should start with Hilbert space and structures on Hilbert spaces, and ultimately try to find something like emergent geometry from that more basic structure rather than the other way around. So, you know, in other words, perhaps the geometry ultimately is emergent, and the more fundamental thing is the quantum structure of the Hilbert space, together with some additional, say, subalgebra structures or what have you. And so at least I think that's a worthwhile set of ideas to think about, and that's partly what I've been doing.
Hi, this is Lucien Hardy. So you talked about the obstruction to having local subalgebras in the context of gravity. Is that remark restricted to sort of an idea of quantum gravity? What about in the classical gravity? Is there a similar obstruction? If you just take standard classical general relativity, does the same obstruction exist?
Well, I think all that I said today could be phrased in the language of Poisson brackets, actually. But so, you know, in the sense that you have, well, where I had non-zero commutators, you would have non-zero Poisson brackets. So it's sort of closely related. But really, I want to think about the structure of the quantum theory. And, you know, we have sort of a different story we tell when we think about the classical structure of the theory and classical locality. We sort of approach that from a different angle often.
Okay, maybe a final question for myself. So you mentioned on the slide that when you talked about locality and the Wilson loops, that there's a subtlety with the closed universe case or a positive cosmological constant. Can you comment a bit on that?
Sure, yeah. So I said that if we're in Minkowski space and we put down a mass, then there are field lines that run off to infinity and we can't avoid that. But we know that there are consistent there's a consistent description, or we expect in the quantum theory, there's a consistent description of something that looks like De Sitter space, or more general closed universes, where, you know, if we think about the global slicing, in De Sitter space, we really have matter on a sphere. So where do the field lines go? And, I think, a little reflection on that, you realize that you, of course, can have a consistent description of things, but one way of putting it is you can think about the the De Sitter-Schwarzschild solution, and you can have effectively field lines going from one point to another, but you've also got to take into account sort of the back reaction on the whole space. So certainly we have we can consistently you consider particles in De Sitter space, and it's just a slightly more subtle story.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Is there any further question? Otherwise, I think you might want to let people go to lunch. No, sorry, Bianca has one last question.
Okay. That's actually more a clarification, because, Steve, you considered these nice observables, which also have a physical interpretation in terms of what is being created. And Lee mentioned, for instance, these Geller field relational observables. And so to bring it into perspective, so these you can in principle use, so they have causal Poisson brackets, so causal commutators. But there's this additional effect, which you also have a paper on, which is that indeed there's an additional term in the Poisson brackets or in the commutators, which doesn't allow you to resolve two points, which are very nearby, and where you would have very high energy in these things. So this is the disadvantage in using metafields, that if you want to resolve two nearby points with metafield, you need very high energy for these metafields. And so that's basically all, I mean, and myself, as you know, we did some other, we used some other gauge fixing, what I called EDM clocks, which in lowest order are local, but in higher order in perturbation theory would be non-local. So it seems that this problem with non-locality or this kind of basic bound on resolution seems to appear in all kinds of different relational approaches, or also a new kind with these stressing fields.
Yeah, I've focused on, obviously I'm aware of and have thought of the more constructions of relational observables, as you say, involving scalar fields and so on. And those are a little more complicated, and I agree with you. I think they share similar features or troubles, really, one should say. And so today I've just focused on sort of the simplest things. But I think if one really is trying to introduce, say, relational observables where one is relating, creating a particle, say, at some position determined by another field configuration, you run into these same kinds of issues with with, for example, the gravitational field being activated and sort of the back reaction on the gravitational field, for one thing. There are other proposals where you have just sort of pure scalar relational constructions, and I think there are claims that, at least at leading order, those don't encounter the same kind of challenge. But it's hard for me to see how that that's going to still be the case when you go to higher order, I think, as you say. So by and large, I think I'm basically agreeing with what you've just said.
Okay, I think also Bianca was nodding in agreement with what you said. I think I will allow the people here now to go to lunch, because we have only 45 minutes left. So let's thank the speaker again.